This is Wednesday, September the 10th, 2013, and this is Primetime Sports, Canada's most listened to sports talk presentation on the Fan Radio Network and on Sportsnet in high definition. Bob McCown, Damien Cox in our Toronto studios. Later in the program, Steve Faneroo of ESPN will join us, along with Eugene Melnyk, the owner of the Ottawa Senators. But first, a bunch of baseball things to discuss. And we've spent some time in the last few minutes with Alex Anthopoulos and separately talking about this announcement by the Blue Jays earlier this week. Well, that'd be yesterday. That they will play two exhibition games, spring training games, if you will, in Montreal at the Big O. Alex Anthopoulos actually is there doing the dog and pony show in Montreal as we speak. Jonah Carey of Grantland joins us, and we'll talk about a bunch of things. But that's at the top of the list, sort of, Jonah. A lot of people looking at this, and mostly Montreal Expos fans, looking at this as some sort of an indication that maybe baseball can return to Montreal. First of all, do you see that happening in any way, shape, or form in the foreseeable future? And secondly, do these two games play any role in any kind of decision making?
There are two factors that have to take place for Major League Baseball to come to Montreal. Number one is Major League Baseball has to change its mind. I honestly think that's the biggest obstacle. Even if you had a billionaire who was willing to build a stadium and willing to spend the expansion fees or the relocation fees or whatever, I think it still comes down to the league. The other factor is having that wealthy owner. So those two things have to come together, and those are very big long shots at this point in time. Major League Baseball, again, being the bigger one because of the institutional memory. As for whether these games have an effect, I look at it a little bit like I do when we got a bunch of Expos fans over to Rogers Centre. I mean, it's going to be a party. I think that you'll see a lot of people show up and wear, you know, Vladimir Guerrero jerseys and hang out and have drinks, and that'll be that, who aren't necessarily rooting for the Jays or the Mets. In fact, might not be rooting against the Jays, but it'll just be sort of that nature. Honestly, the reason that this is being done, and with good reason by the Jays, by the way, is because the Jays are trying to raise their national profile. I mean, I think that they should be playing games like this in Vancouver. I think they should do everything they can to really, truly capture the audience from all over the country. Quebec is probably the toughest nut, in some senses, because you've got some people who are loyal to the Expos and maybe will never flip over to the Jays, but it certainly doesn't hurt to try.
I got to say, though, you know, Jonah, and I know you're very familiar with all things Expos, writing a book and doing all that sort of stuff. This almost seems a little unfair to the fine folks of Montreal. Put the carrot out there again, get them thinking, you know, and if they don't get a great crowd out of the stadium that nobody wants to go to anyways, you know, is that another black mark against Montreal? It just seems a little bit almost unfair. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I guess we're jumping ahead here. I mean, it's not clear that there was going to be lousy crowds. It's possible that they could draw well. I know the company Evenco is pretty good at what they do. And, I mean, I'm going to fight everybody I know. So maybe we'll get, I don't know, a couple dozen more people maybe show up to the ballpark. I intend to strike up some interest. Yeah, it's...
You can bring books.
And I'm going to bring, oh, don't worry. This is like manna from heaven marketing campaign for Up, Up, and Away, the new book on the Montreal Expo coming out March 11th, available for pre-order on Amazon.com. But yes, certainly it is the case that is exciting. And I hope they don't see it as a black mark. I think it's just kind of one of those fun things. And you know, I'm rooting for it to do well, somewhat from the Montreal standpoint. But listen, I mean, it's a Jays venture. And if the Jays do well, then good on them.
There's a couple factors to be considered in this. I mean, as we talk about reasons for this, I mean, I do buy into the notion that the Blue Jays are well aware that they have sort of abandoned their national branding that they used to do, actually.
Yes.
And started the refocus during the past winter, during the off season, by reinstituting the caravan, which didn't make stops everywhere, but they had a bunch of players that they took out west. They went to Saskatoon, and I can't remember where all they went. So it's an effort to extend the brand into other markets, Montreal, of course, being one. And, I mean, they'll go to Vancouver in a couple of years, I think, and play a couple of exhibition games out there. The other that's more interesting that hasn't been talked much about, certainly I don't know of anywhere other than this program, there was a movement, I want to say about 2 years ago, maybe slightly less than that, to examine the possibility of putting a Blue Jays AAA team in Montreal.
Mm.
And I don't know how far it went, but I know that it was active and that it was going to require building a stadium and that the at Rogers may not necessarily have been opposed to that. It got derailed, and I don't know why, but I wonder if even that's sort of in the back of their minds still. And when I say derailed, I mean, well, we stopped hearing about it and people stopped talking about it around here. But maybe that's still in the back of their minds. Could you revert to the 1950s, early 60s, when the Expos were had a AAA franchise?
The Montreal Royals existed for many years, of course. And, you know, it's possible. There's a few obstacles here. Number one is, where are you going to play the games? Olympic Stadium is not a suitable for baseball.
You'd have to build a 20,000-seat stadium.
Somebody's got to pay for that, and that comes down to the same thing as it's always come down to, is who's going to do it. It's interesting. I had a separate conversation on another show about the idea of baseball in Canada and baseball in the U.S., and one of the things which sunk the Expos was they wouldn't build a stadium. The province basically kiboshed it at the time. Hospitals were closing, and there were some things that people, you know, real people needed to attend to, and so they did, and it was bad optics to build a baseball stadium. And you know, in America, it was totally fine. I'll build this. Here's $600 million, blah, blah, blah. It's kind of changed on this side of the border in the States now, where people aren't really up to it.
That's right.
And I'm not so sure that in Quebec there's a sentiment. I still think that there might be an anti-stadium sentiment. In other words, you know, to get government money in there, it would be hard to imagine. And even if you were to get government money for the people of Quebec, if they were going to build a stadium, my feeling is that they would say, well, hey, if we're going to do this, why not just tack another $20,000 onto this thing and go get the Expos back? So I just think that there are a lot of obstacles, and most of them are financial, that would maybe prevent that from happening.
Do you have an opinion of the Montreal Baseball Project? That's Warren Cromartie's group, right?
Yep, Montreal Baseball Project. Cromartie has been making some efforts. There's also a group called Expos Nation, which I guess is a little bit more grassroots, run by a guy named Matthew Ross, and he's been the one. They were responsible for the couple of events in Rogers Centre, and both of them have kind of made these efforts over the last couple of years. Again, the whole world, it's a big viral marketing campaign for my benefit, and I really appreciate it. It's awesome. But, there's just been this whole sudden, upswing in interest. They had this 2 summers ago. They had a 1981 Expos reunion in Montreal, and it was a packed event. They filled up a ballroom. It was really cool. There's been some, you know, talk here and there about maybe a 94 Expos reunion. And let me do some math. 20 years after 94, there would be 2014. Hey, you know what? Maybe we'll get Larry Walker, Pedro Martinez to come when my book comes out, too. That'd be great. But, I just get the sense that there is a lot of stuff happening on that front. Again, the problem is you can generate interest. There are people that are real Expos fans in Montreal. The bigger problem is the money problem and the institutional memory. How are you going to get Major League Baseball to sign off with putting a franchise there when in their minds it was a salted earth campaign? It got so bad by the end that it was embarrassing to the league.
With Jonah Carey of Grantland. Joe Girardi, Buck Showalter almost come to blows last night after the Yankees thought that the Orioles' third base coach was stealing signs. We had a sign-stealing allegations here in Toronto.
It was the man in the white suit.
Yeah, in center field was allegedly stealing signs. This is all very intriguing and interesting, and certainly, if you've seen the video of it, extremely entertaining. And yet, at the core of it, baseball is really one of the fundamentals of baseball is if you can steal signs, you steal them. That's why the catchers don't, put up a cardboard sign to the pitcher saying, curveball on the outside corner. You know, they dangle their fingers between their legs and try and keep it away from everybody else. Everybody wants to know, why is this? I mean, was this just being stupid?
You mean in terms of Girardi protesting?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's funny because it's not really, it's not in the rule book. There's nothing exactly that says that you can't steal signs.
Of course.
Unwritten rules. Some of the unwritten rules are spectacularly stupid, like not being able to bunt in a no-hitter or whatever. What if you're down 1-0 and you're in a pennant race? I mean, of course you should be able to bunt. And quite frankly, you should be able to do whatever you want at any time. So that's fine. I object to pitchers throwing at anybody and under any circumstances. I think that's totally ridiculous. And you don't enforce frontier justice because a guy bunted. That's all dumb. This is a little trickier because it really does have to do with the result of the game. It is an unwritten rule, not a written rule. But, of course, the other team's going to be mad if they think that you're trying to steal their sign. So it's allowed, but at the same time, there's an understanding that if you try to do it, then you're probably going to get retaliated against. So Yeah, and I'm sure that if you brought a player on instead of me, they would say, oh, it's very important, da-da-da-da. It's hard for me as an outsider to look at it and say that because I didn't, you know, play professional baseball. But it just seems, I'm kind of with you, it's probably a little bit too much ado about very little.
Now, one of them, was it Showalter was making throat-slashing signs? I mean, does baseball get involved in this, or they just say that's boys being boys?
Showalter, I'm in Bristol, Connecticut this week, and I'm doing baseball tonight for you. Showalter is in a situation where he just has this vendetta against the Yankees. I mean, not long ago, he was talking about this whole idea of Alex Rodriguez and whether he's going to be suspended and what accounts against the cap and da-da-da-da. And he didn't say, well, this is just unfair because of A-Rod. He was talking about payroll implications, that if they can get away from that money, then they could sign Matt Wieters when he's a free agent, who's the current right. Orioles catcher. I mean, that is, you know, next-level paranoia to be thinking about your catcher as a free agent in 2015, and maybe if this steroids guy isn't suspended now, then that opens the door in 2015 to poach your player. But Showalter's like that. I think it's a combination of him legitimately being paranoid and tweaking the Yankees, too, quite frankly. He used to be a Yankees manager, very competitive guy, fancies himself a smart person, and he's just decided to make the Yankees his mortal enemy.
I still say stealing signs is still part of baseball. You don't go berserk over.
That's why they have signs.
That's why they do it. That's why the third base coach stands there and rubs his chin and scratches his arm and rubs his leg and does it in different orders. So
they just call over.
They
something.
Just say, "Hey, bud, yeah, dummy." So you know what's intriguing? Here in Toronto, we bemoan the fact that the Toronto Blue Jays, got 12 games under 500 and couldn't get out of it. Although they did actually. They got back to two games over and then fell right back again. But simultaneously and without much fanfare, the Los Angeles Dodgers were at one point 14 games under 500. And I remember I remember the conversation basically being, well, okay, so it's been a failure this year, but we had a lot of injuries and the Dodgers will come back next year. And then it morphed into, well, you know, they're playing better now. They certainly have a chance to win the division. They'll never get the wild card, but they could win the division. And they're going to win the division, but they could have won the wild card too. This is one of the great turnarounds, in spite of this past weekend, that I can remember in baseball. A team being that bad and then being this good. How good are these Los Angeles Dodgers?
They went through a stretch, 50 games or 60 games, some round number where it was the best in the history of baseball. That had never happened before. They just 42-8 or something like that. They just went totally bananas. So, it is historic in the sense of the turnaround within an individual season. We've seen a bunch of worst-to-first situations where you're really bad. Next year, you're really good. The 08 Rays.
Not in the same year, though.
Not in the same year. That's the thing. Braves and Twins did it the year after, but the same year is very unusual. And, it is a very good team, but it's funny because I don't think they're as good as they've been in this current streak. Some of these guys are playing so well you can't believe it, like Hanley Ramirez and Yasiel Puig, especially. I mean, they're hitting 360, and just everything they put in play lands for hit. It's been unbelievable. And the forgotten man in all this is Matt Kemp. Matt Kemp is an MVP-caliber player who is not in that lineup and probably will not be in that lineup for the rest of the year. Andre Ethier has turned into a pedestrian player. He's not as good as he used to be, and he wasn't that great before. So they have holes on this team. It's just that the run prevention, combined with Puig and Ramirez, has been so spectacular. I mean, even if you can pitch against them, you're going to lose 2-1 because of Greinke and Kershaw, and even Ricky Nolasco has been tremendous. That's been the thing with this team, is so good at run prevention. So, you know, it's an interesting situation. I think, by the way, it does bode kind of well for the Jays. You talked about them being 12 under. Obviously, it's not going to happen the same season. This year is over for them. But I keep coming back to this. I just think that the Dodgers, what they're doing is this best possible scenario. You could roll the dice and you would never get something this good. The 2013 Jays, to me, it's like roll the dice and it could never be this bad. It's snake eyes seven times in a row. It's injuries, it's the pitching not working. I still look at this roster and I say, this is a talented roster. Most people thought they'd contend. What happened? And I don't think we were all totally wrong. I just think that everything that could have gone wrong with the Jays did. And to me, the Dodgers are a little bit of a sign of hope for the Jays. You get a couple of reinforcements over the offseason, you got a shot.
Tweak here, tweak there, and everybody plays to their potential, and I don't mean above their potential, but just to it, and it is a competitive team. Very quickly, literally 10 seconds, Cardinals, Reds, Pirates. What a battle. Who emerges victorious in that group?
I like the Cardinals because of the one game lead, and I like their young pitchers pitching well. The Pirates have been playing 500 ball since July 1st. I think they're the worst of the three teams.
Always good of you to join us. Thanks, Jonah.
Thanks, gents.
Jonah Carey of Grantland.
Be kind of sad if the Pirates didn't make it after the great season they've had, but they're in tough.
Yeah, well, the race has been joined by the Cincinnati Reds, and the Cardinals are still hanging around.
Now, the Pirates are in Texas tonight. Are they playing Texas, right?
Haven't seen.
I believe, because I think they won. Just double-check that on me, because if that's the case, they are, yes? I thought interleague play has gone, so they are. Don't you think interleague play has gone late this year?
No, they have to because you're forgetting that the Houston Astros came over to the American League. So you always have one interleague series going year long.
There should be no interleague play in September.
You can't do anything about it with 15-15.
Well, they got to fix it.
You can't.
Well, they're going
to
have to.
They only have to put a team in Montreal. Actually, they're going to have to put two teams in Montreal.
Okay, the Wanderers and the Maroons will be back.
What are we doing when we come back? Melnick? Eugene Melnick, Ottawa Senators, next when Primetime continues on the Fan Radio Network and Sportsnet. Only 3 minutes past the hour. What the big delay was there.
What are you arguing with people all the time?
Well, I don't know why we're not on. The music starts, we should come on.
And you're arguing with our...
No, I'm arguing with them. And I couldn't go on. They wouldn't let me go on because they said the network wasn't ready yet. And I said, screw the network.
Well, then get on with it.
I don't care about the network. I only care about you and your happiness.
Oh, that changes everything.
Thank you very much. So I don't pretend to understand all of this, but here's what I do know. Eugene Melnick, the owner of the Ottawa Senators, says he's lost about $95 million in the years that he's owned the team, or about $10 million a year. He had an application, a bid, he was, for that the football stadium, right? And I guess he didn't get to do that.
Nope.
Now, apparently, he's got a blueprint for something called the Canadian Tire Center. It includes 300,000 square feet of retail, 800 hotel rooms, 900 residential units. And I think he wanted to put the, because all these casino applications are going on all over Ontario. I guess he wanted to put the casino at this this
and,
thing.
And they have renamed the arena, the Canadian Tire Arena in Ottawa from Scotiabank.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if we're going to find out whether it's there or not, because I don't know exactly what the geography is. Anyway, so apparently city council has said, no, we want to put the casino, assuming there is one, at the Rideau Carlton Raceway. Eugene Melnick is with us and as the owner of the Ottawa Senators. How am I doing in describing your plight?
You're pretty close, Bob. How are you?
Good, pal.
Damien, how are you?
I'm fine, Gene. How are you doing? Getting ready for the season, I imagine.
Oh, I tell you, I'm pumped. It's the countdown's on.
So where is the Canadian Tire Center, this prospected hotel, residential, retail complex?
Well, the Canadian Tire Center is... You know, the arena.
Oh, it is.
It was renamed, It used to be Scotiabank, and we renamed it.
That I know.
Right. And a sign just went up. It looks gorgeous. But we've got about 80 acres of land there.
Right.
And, there's supposed to be, so for like 7 years, going back to McGinty days, I came in and said, if there's going to be a chance, I'd love to build a casino out there. Because, you go across the river from downtown Ottawa, maybe 15 minutes, and you're at Lac de Lamy, which is a nice casino.
Been there.
And he said himself, he said, 90% of the plates are Ontario.
Yep.
But we get 90%, and all the problems come back to our province, they get all the cash. So he says, we're very open to this. So we started working on a plan, then all of a sudden the OLG gets involved and everybody else gets involved and said, this is going to be a big master plan.
Yep.
So, we're ready. I've got casino operators. I'm really a landowner. I've got about 80 acres of land around Kanata. And, the city is growing that way. It's growing west. And, it's like Mississauga was 30 years
ago. Yeah, I gotcha.
It's like, and then, all of a sudden these guys come out, and it was hilarious. People submit the OLG, and this is where there's a lot of, bull going around. The OLG went to everybody and said, okay, guys, tell us where you don't want a casino. And because, you know, we got all these submissions and we don't want to spend hundreds of hours on looking at submissions when you guys aren't going to approve a casino in this area, like next to a, you know, national monument or something. So Kingston comes in and they got this little tiny square in the middle of the town. They said, look, that's the only place we don't really want. You take, then you go to Ottawa, and they blacked out the whole city other than Rideau, the racetrack. And I go, no. You can't do that. That's called sole sourcing. That's actually illegal, number one. You can't do it. And they go ahead and they try to do it. And,
so they want the casino at the racetrack, period, end of story.
They have one now. They got a bunch of slots there.
Right.
Okay. Now you got to understand look. I'm a big, huge horse racing guy.
Yeah. I know.
I've been going to racetracks since I was 16. So you're talking to somebody that knows racetracks, knows the plight of racing, and in fact, I lobbied to get Woodbine, you know, not to shut down Woodbine with their casino money, because I said, you know, it's not good.
Kills and horse racing.
Well, you know, they spent 20 years turning it into a world-class place, which is now on TVG and all these networks and everything else, and
yep.
And now they're going to blow it all up. So I lobbied for them. But this is a little tiny sea track that wouldn't even make it in the Idaho State Fair.
Geographically, Gene, because, I mean, I know Ottawa a little bit, but I've never been to the racetrack. Where's the racetrack located?
It's kind of like in a bad area, but it's not a great area. It's, you know, kind of near the airport-ish, but downtown, and it's like nowhere. Mm. There's no public transit or anything like that. I mean, you know, you would never go there, put it that way.
Kind of southwest-ish?
Yeah, I think so.
City core?
I mean, I wouldn't set foot in it, so I got to be honest with you.
All right.
I was there about 15 years ago, just to lay down a quick bet for a horse and watch a race, and I was out of there.
Well, let me ask you this, because this is all the push and pull, and we know these debates go on over projects, and Ottawa's had a lot with Lansdowne Park, et cetera, et cetera. But let me ask you this. Do you think the city of Ottawa owes you an opportunity to do something because of what the senators have meant to the city, and can the senators survive if you can't build a casino?
Well, there's two things. One is fair play. I didn't ask for anything. All I said is, guys, go through a normal process. Like, you're supposed to do a bidding. Like, there's supposed to be submissions of a bid, and why is this the best spot? Why should we do it at the casino? Why should we do it downtown? Why should we do it in Kanata? What economic impact? What environmental impact? Who's got the most parking? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And these guys just said, no. It's going to be here or it's not going to be anywhere, period. You don't even submit. And, you know, I didn't win, lose, or draw. I don't mind losing, but these guys didn't even give you a shot. Then you got, like, the mayor. You know, I don't know what planet he's flown in from, but he then turns around and says, no, this is the only place we're going to do it. His deputy mayor, Steve DeRoche, says in this big, big meeting, you know, all the powwows get together, there's too much competition in the world right now.
What?
And I said, you know what? They should have named Neptune after you. You know, that's where you belong. Because what did you just say? Tell me again how you got elected. And but look, at the end of the day, I don't want to dwell on it. At the end of the day, it's all going to come out.
Is it dead, though, Gene?
Who benefited? How? Why? How come they got sole sourcing, period, full stop? You can't get away with that. And it's all going to come out.
Is it dead for you?
No, not you kidding. We're just getting warmed up.
Okay, that's what I figured.
And back to the question I asked you, do you believe that Ottawa owes you, if not owes you a casino license, owes you the opportunity to do something to support your hockey team that's losing a chunk of money a year right now?
Not me. They owe everybody. Like I said, I don't care if I win, lose, or draw. Just do it right. Do a competition. It's like you're not the only guys in the race. And let's see if you can stand on your own. If I lose, I lose. That's okay. I go home and come up with some, you know, a plan C. Right now, there's no plan C. Can we survive? You know what? It all depends how the team does. It all depends. Can we find a third revenue source? but you know, it's there's only so much. This what you know. I tried to build, like you said earlier, a soccer stadium. I said, okay. They say, well, you guys are all in the boonies out in Canada. I said, yeah, because I've been trying to build the damn thing for 10 years now, and you know, you. So I say, you know what? I get to Garber, the commissioner of the soccer league. Okay, so we fly around in helicopters. I show him where the place. He says, look, you get a stadium in there, virtually without committing. He says, you got a team. This is a great place, beautiful. Propose that. No, what do they do? They're going to bring CFL football back to Ottawa a third time, and they gave a $400 million gift of land to a group of insiders there, and that was it. So I get killed there. Now, all of a sudden, I don't know what their fixation is, but if anybody knows about horse racing, these horses run for $4,000 a race. Okay, $4,000.
Yeah.
That's their purse. I heard that before slots came in, it was $2,000.
Yike.
But that's the level of competition you're talking about versus the cheapest of the cheapest races anywhere, like in like Toronto, would be 40 G's.
Yeah. Is the place a dump?
Oh. It's,
yes, no.
I wouldn't go there without an army.
Yeah, well, yeah, but you have an entourage in the best of circumstances anyway. So who are you kidding? Hey, listen.
I got
2 minutes here, and I haven't had a chance to talk to you. When the Alfredson thing broke, the cat fight, you were in Europe, and I want to give you. You got 90 seconds here. You want? I know it's a little bit post facto, but I mean, are you over it? Is it water under the bridge? Are you still steaming?
Nah, I'm not steaming at all. It's all water under the bridge. We've turned that page a long time ago. You know, we're all excited about the team we've got coming this year. You got Bobby Ryan coming in. He's all pumped. Turris. You've got Spets coming in. McCulloch, your top defenseman, your top goalie. You know, if we stay healthy, even marginally healthy, we're going to go deep. And I got to tell you, for all the Leaf fans out there, I'm proud of what they've done. Not the management. Because they're going to be competitive this year. They really will. And I'm looking forward to some great rivalries. And I think it's going to be a great season of hockey. And I think there's going to be some surprises. I really do.
Oh, you're being extremely diplomatic,
really,
which is really unlikely.
I'm not even sure he wasn't being a little sarcastic.
No, I'm not. That's what a nice summer does.
You only have nice summers.
Yeah, no kidding. Mr. Melnick, it's always a pleasure. We thank you very much for your time, as always, and haven't seen you for a while. We hope to run into you someplace.
You got it. Take care, guys.
Thanks, Eugene. Eugene Melnick, owner of the Ottawa Senators. One of my favorite guys.
Never a dull interview.
Have you ever sat down with him?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like just with your feet up and a beer or something like that?
Oh, yeah.
It just goes on.
Yeah.
It doesn't end.
No, he's...
You have to leave. You have to say, Melnick, I've had enough of you. Goodbye.
Because he really enjoys people. So it's a fascinating thing what's going on in Ottawa. And I think the trick is for him now, he doesn't want to be turned into the bad guy up there. And you know, no. Ottawa being Ottawa, but his hockey team's losing money even, you know, and they're not going to spend to the cap this year. It starts getting to be a real balancing act. So we'll see what happens.
Former NFL players settled with a league in their concussion litigation suit. They got $765 million. That's pretty good. That's a lot of cake. But they were looking for $2 billion. Did they settle too soon? Did they get scared? Were they afraid that they might not win this thing? Or, as their legal counsel told us on this program a couple of weeks ago, actually on the day that they settled, he said they had to take the money because too many of their players were in need right now.
Right.
Steve Fainer of ESPN has taken a look at this story, and he'll join us next to give us his take on the NFL settlement with the former players. That's when Primetime continues on the Fan Radio Network and Sportsnet. 17 before the hour. Primetime continues on the Fan Radio Network, coast to coast, and Sportsnet in high definition. McCowan here with Cox over there. Not far enough over there, but over there. So was it a couple weeks ago that they announced the settlement, or was it last week they announced the settlement?
No.
A couple weeks ago,
was it? Maybe two. Anyways. It was in the...
So it was a few weeks ago. The NFL players settled in their legal action against the NFL with regard to concussions. They were seeking about $2 billion.
No, not the NFL players, because that implies it might be the association. A group of retired NFL players.
Oh, that's what I meant to say.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So they're looking for $2 billion. Clearly, they believe they've got a strong case. They wind up all of a sudden settling for $765 million. Lead counsel is on this program. We talked to him about it. And he says the principal reason they settled was because they had immediate need. They had many players that had immediate need for money, and they were afraid this thing was going to drag out too long. And so they figured, you know, bird in the hand, right, kind of deal. It's been suggested that there may be another reason, and that is because the judge in the case was saber-rattling that he or she may throw this whole thing out.
She.
Steve Fainer of ESPN has written on this and been exploring this story, and he joins us on the telephone. Hi, Steve. How you doing?
Good. How you guys doing?
Good. How are you doing with the explanation? I mean...
Good. Good.
Essentially... Go ahead. Huh? Please go ahead.
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, right? I don't think that the lawyers are being disingenuous when they say there's a lot of immediate need out there. There are a lot of players who are hurting. There are a lot of people who need medical assistance and financial assistance. And I think there was a real sense that this was going to drag on for years. But the lawyers had also had extended consultations with the judge in the case, Anita Brody, and she had signaled to both sides, not just the players, but the NFL, that there was a real strong, that she was signaling strongly that neither side was going to be necessarily happy with the outcome. She was facing a decision where the NFL had filed a motion to dismiss the case, and there was a decision pending on that, and she had signaled to both sides that neither side was going to be necessarily thrilled with the outcome of that decision, and so the incentive for them to settle was strong.
And the incentive for the NFL, and at the end of the day, for $765 million, I think a lot of people are arguing, I don't know how you feel, that basically they were buying themselves out of a lot of bad publicity as opposed to doing the right thing.
Well, I think it's a mix of different things, like most things. And I think that, you know, they were facing the start of the season. This was going to be hanging over the season. The judge, among other things, had suggested to the NFL that she was not going to entirely dismiss the case. And so although there were a lot of legal questions around whether the players, you know, had a good shot in court, the NFL was facing the possibility of discovery in which their own officials might have been deposed and possibly even forced to testify if it came to a trial. There was a strong possibility that the damages could be more if it got that far. And so I think there was a calculation on the NFL's part that the time to settle was right. Now, I don't know. I mean, I have mixed feelings about the money. You know, I mean, $750 million is a lot of money. And, you know, the NFL is a $10 billion industry. They rake in $10 billion in revenue every year. So, you know, it's not like tobacco litigation type money, but it's a lot of money that can be used to help a lot of people. Whether it's enough money, I think, remains to be seen.
It's $25 million per team, spread out over 10 years, essentially. It's nothing.
Oh, no. In terms of the financial impact on the league,
zero.
I wouldn't say it's negligible or zero, but I'd say it's not going to make a big dent in the league's financial future.
It's fly on an elephant, with all due respect,
but you
Steve.
Know, but you know what? And Steve touched on this about players in real need. I think it's one thing for us to sit here and say, it's not enough. They should have got more. It's nothing to the NFL. And at the same time, there's people sitting at home with players with serious brain injuries that
need help.
Oh, sure,
I get that.
And if you have no guarantee you're going to win the case or get anything, at some point you've got to make a decision, Steve.
Yeah. The other thing is that, I mean, if you, you know, they were seeking initially when they started to talk about a settlement a little more than $2 billion. Even if they had gotten that, that too would have been a relatively small amount for an industry the size of the NFL.
Right.
So no matter how it came out, this was not going to like bring down the NFL or even create any amount of, you know, real financial havoc for the league. It was about sort of, so there's a sort of psychological value to having a B in the settlement, which I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't understate. I mean, I think it's significant. But there's also the amount of money that the players are going to have to deal with these issues. I, you know, I think the real issue around the money for me is it really going to be enough? And I don't think it's clear whether it is.
The other part of it that obviously the National Football League insisted on, and that might be concerning, I know is concerning for a number of the players, is that in the settlement, they do not have to acknowledge responsibility or liability for the injuries that the players incurred. Your thoughts on that portion of it? How should we react to that?
I don't think that's surprising at all. I mean, if you're talking about a settlement, there's not going to be an admission of guilt associated with that. You know, the facts sort of, I think, will ultimately speak for themselves, and people can make their own determinations around it. The league spent the better part of 20 years denying that this was an issue and attacking independent scientists who were making a very persuasive case that that football was causing brain damage in an increasing number of players. And the NFL fought that for years and years and years. I mean, I think one of the more damning parts of the settlement is that it's part of it is going to be used to set up a nationwide network to treat these players. And that is a really relatively small amount of money. I think it's something on the order of $50 to $70 million. And, you know, that's something that the NFL could have done when this problem began to surface. Instead, they fought their own players, you know.
The other part is there was $10 million assigned to research. I mean, that's laughable. That's maybe one study.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I mean, the NFL's already, you know, they've given $30 million to the NIH. They've given $60 million to GE for, you know, for this kind of research. You know, not to mention the tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars that's pouring into concussion research now. I mean, one of the real legacies of the lawsuit, I think, is going to be, you know, the incredible scientific advances we're going to see over the next several years. I mean, you know, now comes this part where I shamelessly promote our upcoming book. So, you know, my brother and
we
I...
We would expect no less.
So my brother and I, we have a book coming out called League of Denial next month, in which we tried to document sort of what's happened over the last, you know, over the last three decades. And one of the things that I think is really interesting is that, you know, the concussion research generally in the medical profession was not something that was even really a major thing until, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. And it's because of this issue in the NFL and because of the work that the NFL players, the retired NFL players have done to make it an issue that's really led to a lot of really important research that's going on now. And I think that's going to be a real legacy because I think we're going to understand very soon how widespread is this problem among former NFL players, which I think is a question that's not really clear yet.
I mean, I guess that's the thing, and since we're talking about amount of money and the difference is going to make to people, I think the sad stories are not going to end, are they, of players, whether it's Jim McMahon or whoever. There's going to be more.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It goes on, and how do you deal with them?
Yeah, so let me give you some perspective on that.
You got to do it in 30 seconds.
In 2005, there had not been one single player who had been diagnosed with brain damage, one single NFL player who had been diagnosed.
Right.
With brain damage. We're now over 50. And you can't be diagnosed unless you're dead. So, you know, where this is headed, it's not really clear, but I mean, that kind of speaks for itself.
Steve, good of you to join us.
Look forward to
always.
The book.
We look forward
Thanks
to the book,
for having
too.
Me.
Thanks a lot. And best to your brother, too. Steve Faneru from ESPN, book coming out soon. And It's a story we've been following, and that's where it sits, $765 million. As I said, a lot of money.
Yep.
But nowhere near what they were looking for.
Well, how do you,
and a lot of players who were involved in this suit, very unhappy.
How do you compensate someone who commits suicide or their family because of a brain injury they picked up playing in the National Football League? What amount of money compensates for that?
That's a great question to which there is no definitive answer. Our thanks to Steve Faneroo for joining us, to Eugene Melnick and Jonah Carey. For Damian Cox, Bob McCown, have a nice evening. We'll see you tomorrow night right here on Primetime.